Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 95 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Michael Socker, who was a lovely, lovely young man. I really enjoyed meeting him. I've been a fan of his work for a while. We chatted a bit over Twitter and we hooked this up for you guys to enjoy. It was really good fun. I need to get the plugs in. SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com is where you can support the podcast. There's stuff from the label. You can buy my Edinburgh Fringe show, which is just £5, and you can just watch my whole Edinburgh Fringe show, which there's a DVD as well, which has got interviews on there with Tim Key and Kate Tempest and Moose Rock Wonga and Polar Bear and loads of people. But anyway, you can get that. You can get all that at speechfilmrecords.com, but you can also get Team 3W stuff, which is the supporting team of the Distraction Pieces podcast. So check that out. Also, the Distraction Pieces live show is happening soon. It's in August on my birthday, August 3rd, at the Leicester Square Theatre. There'll be loads more information on that as we get closer. But yeah, like save the date type a wedding shit right here. Distraction Pieces live podcast. I'm going to have you guys there. I'm going to be there. It's going to be emotional. We're going to all fall in love with each other. It's going to be my birthday. I might eat some cake. I might have a little drinky drink. It's going to be lovely. This podcast was great fun. Michael Socker, I think, is fantastic. I think it was in the second series of This Is England that he just started to really jump out to me. I was like, I just like this dude's face. Like, what a great face this guy's got. He's got just a great face. Just look at it. Look at his face and listen to his voice. And I loved it. I love his face and his voice. I did in person as well. He's got a great face and voice. Yeah, he's got a good way about him. And he was great in that. And then his character grew and grew and grew over the series. And he's fantastic. And he's also, he was in Being Human, smashed it in that. But also Aliens is what got me to get in touch and get him on. Because I started watching Aliens, which is a new show that was recently on 4. And yeah, it's cracking. And it's got him, it's got Michael Smiley in, it's got Tom Davis in, it's got a load. So basically, I'm only listening to the ex-Distraction Pieces alumni. If you're tuning into this one and you haven't listened before, we've also had Andrew Shim on, who was in This Is England. We've had Stephen Graham on, who was in This Is England. We've had Paddy Considine on, who was in a lot of Shea Meadows stuff. So we've had Michael Smiley on, we've had Tom Davis on, we've had some good people on. I recommend you check them out. So yeah, that was good. It was a great chat. At the end, I'm going to tell you more about the upcoming guests. That we've got some women coming on at last. People complain, or not complain, but highlight that I haven't had many women on recently. And honestly, I've had tons booked, and we keep having to reschedule and replan. But we've got Kathy Burke and Izzy Sooty both lined up for coming weeks. So they're on their way, I promise you. I'll let you get into the podcast now. Hope you enjoy. I'll be back at the end with further information on all that. This is episode 90. What did I say, 95? With Michael Socker. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, I'm joined by Michael Socker. How you doing, man?
I'm all right, thank you very much.
You're well?
Very well today, yeah.
Thank you for having me up here in sunny Derby.
Yeah, Derbyshire now.
Derbyshire, you're just. It's nice to be. You've kind of lived up this way your whole life,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've lived in the city all my life, born and bred in Derby.
Yeah.
And then through work, I've sort of been here, there, bloody everywhere, and then settled back down just outside of Derby.
Yeah, it draws you back to that. A similar place. I've always said, like with touring and that, the reason I've ended up in the same town is because where you're going to be away for a play or away for a TV show, when you are home, it's handy if it's like familiar and it's home and you've got your family nearby, rather than somewhere you're having to learn where this is again, you know?
Well, my mum's just up the road and my little boy lives in Derby, so it's... Well, his mum lives in Derby, so there's no way really that I can not be here. Yeah, I've got to be around here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like, ideal then, right?
Yes, and I think nowadays with trains and stuff like that, a trip to London's so easy and so quick.
From pretty much everywhere as well. Everywhere, it's getting quicker and quicker to get in and out of London, so...
And also the work ain't in London no more. Well, obviously it is, but not as much. When I first started, it was, you got to live in London, you got to spend a lot of time down there, you've got to hang around with the right people and all that sort of shite, which eventually I just decided I couldn't give a fuck about, really, and I want to be here.
I completely agree, and it's really interesting at the moment. I had Stephen Graham on the other week, and he was saying, like, in his audition for Guy Ritchie originally, he put on a London accent and all that because he thought that they wanted a Cockney.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's exciting, that's kind of changing now. And Aliens, which I'm loving at the moment, is one that's jumping out for me at that, is there's loads of regional accents. The Welsh guy that's the baddie is amazing, having a Welsh baddie. That's great. Yeah. And your voice in and all that. It's not this London-centric thing anymore where everyone has to sound the same. So it's kind of a nice advantage of having the variation there.
I mean, there's a lot of... a lot of work up in like Manchester, Cardiff. So these regional accents are really coming through now. And it is like a relief to hear.
Yeah,
I like it.
Oh, Wales, as well as you said, is definitely becoming a great place for filming and for set. Like there's so many good little studios and locations there that are getting used like crazy now.
They've got cities, they've got fields, mountains, sea. They've got everything there. It's a beautiful place.
It's the variation, isn't it?
It's wicked,
the fact,
man.
They've got, it's why America has been so strong for so long as a location, because you can have such a variation of locations.
Got everything there.
You look over to Wales and Ireland and you can have a nice bustling city, and then up the road you can have a fucking castle in a field.
Yeah, exactly that.
And you're laughing.
My little boy, he was born in Cardiff.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I don't know, that wouldn't make him Welsh.
I don't know.
Just make him somebody who was born in Wales.
He might be Welsh.
Like, he could probably play for the team, couldn't he?
He definitely could. I remember when I was growing up, I'm a Millwall fan, and we had Tony Cascarino, who was playing for Ireland at the time, because like he had a uncle who went to Ireland on holiday once or some random stuff like that. And it was like, yeah, you could definitely get away with that.
Yeah.
So what was your upbringing like in Derby? What were you into at school? Like, were you a good kid at school? Were you a hard worker, or were you a bit of a tearaway?
I think with primary school, I've heard a lot of people sort of say it, I never really felt like I fitted in. I didn't, not that I was bullied or anything like that. I felt a bit different. I thought, I don't know, I just didn't feel quite right.
It's kind of a weird, that middle ground, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're not the cool kids, but then you've also not got that great story of being bullied. I mean, not that it's good to be bullied, but when you're older, you've not got that, oh, I was bullied and this is all a one in the eye for the bullies. Just being in that middle area of like, I wasn't really anything. I wasn't, do you know what I mean? It's a tough one to get through.
I mean, I was fine. I got on it. I had good friends. And I suppose towards the end of primary school, I did start to rebel, I think.
Yeah.
I started realising what injustice was. Sometimes just because they're adults don't mean that they're necessarily right all the time. And I think I was quite vocal, quite young. But I got into... there was a musical at my primary school, Bugsy Malone, and me and my pal, we fucking loved
Bugsy
it,
Malone.
Man.
Yeah.
We just loved it. We didn't know why. We were both from fucking the streets of Derby. For some reason, we loved this musical.
Yeah.
And they were putting it on, and I'd never done no acting before. I'd never done no singing before. I just felt like I really wanted to do this. And I auditioned for the part of Bugsy, and I didn't get it in the end. And it really fucking pissed me off.
I seen the film.
Yeah, that's all I've seen.
Again,
that's
it. That was just, there's countless times since being an adult now, whether I'm watching it kicking off in a club or it kicking off at a football ground or fights on TV, I'll just think, if someone could just go, everyone would stop, everyone would pause, and then that'd break the and that's Bugsy Malone, that's it, holds it back,
and they all look so fucking cool with it, man. I love the gear, I love that gangster, that sort of New York, Chicago gangster sort of theme, but I didn't get it, and the head teacher apologised to me on the last performance. We did like 2 day performance for the parents. It was very fucking primary school play, course.
Yeah. But still, it meant everything
loved
at that
it.
Point.
I played Knuckles. It was a smaller part, but I just fucking thoroughly embraced it. Really ran with it.
Yeah.
And did as good as a job as I could of Knuckles.
Yeah.
And the headmaster was like, "Wow, just fucking crack on."
That's
but in
great.
Doing in not receiving the the part at school. I went and auditioned. Well, my mum got me an audition outside of school for like a local amateur dramatics group.
Yeah.
And I got the part of Bugsy. So I thought, fucking hell, if these fuckers are telling me that I could have done Bugsy, that I've got Bugsy,
yeah,
then I should have got Bugsy. And then I just carried on, really.
Yeah, kind of outside of that school situation where you're this person in the status or whatever else, on stepping aside, and these people who don't know who you are at school or where you are or what your grades are or anything else go, no, you're Bugsy, you're the lead. That's got to be a motivation then.
Well, I think it was that anger, really, that the game of the drive to do it, just to piss the teacher off that didn't give me the part.
Yeah.
And he didn't like me anyway. Like I say, I was getting quite vocal and rebellious by that stage, so I didn't think he fucking liked me.
Yeah.
In fact, I know he didn't. I know he didn't like me.
And that can be a simple thing, man. A teacher that doesn't get on with you, or a teacher who isn't reacting in the right way. Because what you were saying there originally about rebelling, you were kind of saying that you realised injustices and you realised that you could argue stuff.
Yeah.
If you get the right teacher, then that's a positive thing. Then you can have these debates and you can learn. Yeah. It's not just I'm right because I say so.
Yeah.
When kids get to an age where they can start to, I don't know, contemplate and realise things, it should be embraced, right, rather than jumped on and kind of pushed down.
Looking back, I almost think he was scared.
Yeah.
I think I saw through him, and I saw what he was at a young age.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of adults sort of do, and they don't give children or teenagers the time of day, really, when really these teenagers are fucking seeing right through them. And they got them sussed. And they're cleverer than these fuckers that are supposed to be teaching them.
Yeah,
but they see right through them. And I noticed that in secondary school, teachers give up. They'd stop. They didn't want to pay you any attention because they almost felt like they had to put up a shell. Because they knew that you knew, basically, that the illusion had been dropped.
That's it. You're seeing through the magic trick, so you can't see it at all.
Yeah,
I'm going to show someone else it.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Otherwise, it's this scary thing.
Yeah.
So where did it go from there, like acting-wise? If you got into a workshop and started to get that nurtured?
I started doing amateur dramatics. I started playing characters on stage, musicals, being fucking, I don't know, like working-class chimney sweeps to high-class rakes, do you know what I mean? All sorts of different parts, man. I was so fucking lucky. And then I joined the workshop when I was 14 in Nottingham. Obviously, you got Andrew Shim that went there.
Yeah.
You spoke to him. He's a fucking legend, man.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to meet up with him later on. Actually, we're supposed to take the kids out to Nottingham.
Oh, lovely.
But, yeah.
He was still one of the highlights of the podcast because of the point where he walked away from the mic to go and fart.
Oh, yes, and
because he's been brought up well.
I
loved how proud he was. That is like, you know, my mum's brought me up proper. I'm gonna go to the other side of the room.
I don't know if I've ever heard a fart from him. I've smelt a fart, but I've never. He's not the type of lad that just turn around and go.
He'll leave the room. He's a gent with it.
Yeah, he's all right. My mum always told me to fart in the toilet. I was never a farter at school.
No,
I couldn't do it. I was too embarrassed. But like my mates, they'd often fart.
It always annoys me because I do think it's a controllable thing.
It
and people
is.
Deny that
it
it's
is.
Controllable. And being on tour in the past, like when there's lads in the van, people will fart and apologise. If there's a girl on tour with us, that'll all stop. And it's like, well, hang on. You seem to have control over yourself when there was a girl in the van. Now there's not. You're like, oh, I'm sorry. You're not sorry because you've chosen to do that.
You've done it. And you knew the reaction you'd get, but you still did it.
You're not sorry at all. You're proud of it, if anything.
That's a big mum saying, isn't it? You're not sorry. You wouldn't have done it if you were sorry. It's horrible when
you definitely
say
had
that.
A choice. So you started at a workshop.
Yeah, sorry.
A shop then. And Shimmy went there as well. And there was a good, I'd imagine, a good little scene of people in there then.
Shimmy auditioned me. When you were in the group, he was in the over-16s. When you're in the over-16s, you audition the newcomers, like the youngsters that come in. And he was one of those that auditioned me. So I don't really know him back then. But that was a group that you were fucking proud to be part of.
Yeah.
Like you'd got into something magical there.
Yeah.
And I didn't really realise until I did get in. I didn't get in at first because I'd not learnt my lines because I didn't really know the etiquette of auditions or I didn't really know it. I didn't know the world. I didn't really give a shit. So I'd be told I wanted to do a bit of acting, but I wasn't gonna break my leg doing it.
Yeah. It's that weird thing at that age, and particularly from working class families or whatever, it's not seen as necessarily a realistic option.
No.
So you might try it a bit or put a bit of effort in, but you're going to be discouraged from going 100% into it, because chances are you can't be on a big screen. Yeah, that's not something that's attainable. Yeah. So it's that kind of weird middle ground of like,
that's exactly
I'll give it a go, but I don't want to like make a dick out of myself. And it isn't until you start to get some a success with it, I'd imagine, you go, oh shit, I can exactly do this. Let's now start
buckle down,
putting some effort
fucking
in.
Do this. Yeah, but also as well, it was an age at 14 where I was involved in it. I don't know, like gangs and weed and
yeah.
I don't know. At that age, it was so far from the life I was living back home. Going to Nottingham once a week, doing these impros with these fucking amazing people, was so far away from the real, what I was actually living.
Yeah, yeah.
But then also it could come through in improvisations. Like, I don't know, that there were some people who could do what I could do in improvisations, but they seemed to be the ones that were from my background.
And
there was just an element of truth a lot of the time, and that I don't know how the fuckers got it. It was almost like they had to spend their whole lives blagging, and in doing that, they became masters of manipulation. And in even doing that, they became brilliant actors.
Yeah, it's all. I always remember that there's a Mitch Hedberg joke, and he was a stand up, and he was saying that when you're a stand up, everyone pushes you to act or to write on TV or things like that. And he's saying he went for an audition, and they were like under acting experience. He had like, when I'm playing pool and it goes in, I act like I meant it. And this is all my acting experience. Yeah. It's just a life of acting.
That's
actually kind of, in a lot of ways, as I said, if you've grown up having to blag things or having to look confident when you're not, or look calm when you're not, or whatever else, then that is a lesson. It's not the same as some people's traditional upbringings in acting or whatever else, but it's still, you've learned something there and can bring something potentially different that someone who's had a traditional a training can bring, I guess.
And it doesn't matter how the fuck you do it, as long as you convince people that what you're doing is truthful and the story that you're telling is a real story to these fuckers, and people can suspend their disbelief, then who gives a shit how you got there?
Yeah,
as long as you're doing it and you're blagging and you are tricking these people into thinking that you are that character.
As long as you're convincing them.
Exactly, yeah.
Then that's what counts. So I assume kind of This Is England was kind of your first big break. And did that come through that workshop? Obviously, if Shimmy was there, who'd worked with Shane on previous things, was that a kind of, he was, look, I've got some good people, even at his young age, right, kind of?
I didn't know of Shane Meadows, though, back then.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that world, that, I don't know, I was just doing my acting. I was living my life doing my acting and not really thinking I was ever going to work on the telly.
Yeah.
Or on film. And then I got asked to do Shane's film, but only a little part, and I was buzzing. But again, it was like, I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing.
Yeah.
I was just starting college, and I was doing a performance studies course, and when I enrolled and I told them about the This Is England, they were just, wow, Shane Meadows, because he was obviously a local dude. And again, it's, as I did the job, I realised what a fucking legend he was.
Learn what a deal it was,
yeah.
So how was that, though? And again, it seems, I seem to be gradually interviewing everyone who's ever worked with Shane, because I've had Paddy Considine on and Stevie and all of these. But he seems like a great person to work with, particularly early on, because he's not kind of... There is a lot of improvisation. There is a lot of this. It's not a case of turn up, have you learnt your lines? Yeah. Obviously you should, but you still, it's that kind of, it feels like there's more a workshop vibe and everyone kind of are working off each other and,
exactly,
and learning
that
together a bit.
Yeah.
Which must be ideal, right? Particularly... feeling, as said, you're coming into it a bit late or not from a traditional background and you're trying to kind of blag your way through. So to kind of get there and then go, no, let's just blag it. Blag it. Go, oh, shit, I don't have to even hide the fact I'm blagging it, you know?
Well, that's it. The first job is going up. It was going to Nottingham in a taxi, and I landed on set and I just thought, these are all normal people. This ain't what I thought it'd be. Even the crew, everyone's just normal. It was a normal situation, but... it was the first time on a film set, which wasn't obviously normal for me.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was a lovely introduction, really. But it also, I think, made me sort of, I don't know, a bit... I didn't really improve my etiquette, I suppose, for the jobs, because I'd only known that one job, and I thought that's how your job should be.
Yeah,
But I've always enjoyed my time on set, regardless. Just, I've always had a laugh.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed it.
And sometimes it feels like it's good that it's a small role in that situation first, because your character, and we'll get onto it because I want to talk about a few things in between, but it's in the series, as each series went on, like your character really got to come into his own light and really grow, and that's kind of an ideal situation, right, to have that easy thing of, it's not a big deal. You're a smallish character. There's no pressure on you. Yeah. And then once you know everyone and everyone's relaxed, then you're getting these bigger scenes, these heavier scenes, and you get to have that kind of natural growth, rather than straight off, you're getting a cab to Nottingham and you've got scenes all day, every day, and you might feel out of depth.
Fucking hell, I've got to go buckle down, settle down and do it. It was a gradual joy. It was always a fucking joy, man.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I always knew that Harvey's character wasn't really important in 86 and 88, but the fact that I was on them sets, I couldn't give a shit.
Yeah.
I was just happy to be there. And I'd done the same in 90. If they just put me in two scenes, I'd have done it.
Yeah.
And I'd have known that I'd have enjoyed it, and it'd have been a brilliant thing.
It felt in every series, though, in a very natural way, he was kind of earning his place in each, his role growing in each series, because it was, like, in 86, or more, I'd say more in 88, just kind of started to jump out a lot, even though I wasn't in every scene, as you said, but when you were in a scene, it was like, it was, oh, yeah, that's this, and you know what I mean? It stood out and jumped out, so it's kind of a nice progression in that way.
With the characters of This Is England, the dynamic of the actual cast is quite similar to the characters.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's completely.
It's Shane watches as well. He'll watch you in the pub of a night, and he'll see Joe Gilgan just taking the piss out of every fucker and doing it very well, but also being very beautiful, which is Woody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You got Shimmy. Well, they're all very similar.
Exactly,
I think. I think a lot of the characters are similar to them, to the people that play them.
I did a thing a little while ago with Joe, which is a pilot a thing we were working on, and I'd never met him, and the second he walked in, he told about a 20-minute story that was the most ridiculous, unbelievable story ever, and it was like, right, this is Woody coming, and it was all lovely and heartfelt, but it was, everything stopped as he walked in and told this big story, and then it was like, right,
you expect
him. Yeah, exactly.
You go, in 86, I used to just knock on his door just so I could sit down and smoke with him and listen to one of his stories.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I just
love his stories and the way he tells them.
Yeah.
It makes you feel good about yourself, Joe does.
It does.
It'll bring you up. When he's not scared, he doesn't hold back. What he feels, he'll say.
Yeah.
What he notices, he'll say, which I think is a rare trait nowadays.
That was said. We had one day of kind of doing some filming and recording together and instantly clicked because because he's such an open book.
Yeah.
But I think at points he's an open book to the extent he's trying to kind of scare people a little bit. Or do you know what I mean?
If you give you everything to begin with.
Put you at a distance. Yeah. Just so if you're going to bother with me, you know there's this going on and this going on.
And
we just connected instantly on that. I was like, no, this is,
yeah.
I tell you what you should do there. Like, I'm giving you advice on a situation. I met you 10 minutes ago and I'm breaking the Here's what I reckon.
And I want to know about your life.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Let's get into it. But what I liked when I was looking through your IMDb, as is obviously a typical thing before an interview, was after This Is England, you were just a proper jobbing worker. And or jobbing actor and getting a lot of roles doing things like Casualty and stuff like that, which I think is important because I remember when I was speaking to Shimmy, he was saying how tough it was to go from doing his first few things with Shane to then getting another gig where you've got to have learnt your script and you've got to turn up and do it all professionally. And just looking at all the things you did there, it felt as if you threw yourself into that, like rather than trying it once and going, no, I prefer our Shane. I'm going to go over here
and wait
until there's
again.
Another one coming.
Yeah.
It seemed like you just went, right, no, let's try and figure this out. So as how was that to go from that initial setup to, all right, that's not how probably 70-80% of the film or TV industry tends to work. It's not as friendly and family-based a community. Yeah.
Well, I knew, though, after I joined the workshop, after about probably 3 years, 4 years, I'd got to do some amazing things and I don't know, I felt quite confident as an actor and I knew that I wanted to do certain things then.
Yeah.
I wasn't ever, like, doing Shane's film, it wasn't something I was where, I don't know, I don't think I was nervous, I don't think I was any of that. I knew I could play the character.
Yeah.
But then I knew I could play a lot of characters. I knew that I had a lot of prior experience anyway and I knew that it had to go somewhere. If I really want to fucking take this seriously, I've got to do it.
It's the beauty of it there is the fact that if you're associated with Shane, it's kind of feels that it's that whole thing he's known for of plucking people off the streets almost and giving them their big break. But the fact is you and Stephen and several others, already had a load of experience on stage, in even if it's in local or amateur stuff, it's still, you've got that experience, which really, I think, sets you up so well. So,
and the desire and the want to do it.
It's something you were after doing anyway. It's not, you've been plucked, here's an opportunity, all right.
Well, that was a laugh.
I'll go back to the pub now, whatever. It's like, I was already trying to do that. So it's kind of, exciting in that way.
I find it very difficult, I think, my first few proper sort of job in telly jobs, because I knew that I wasn't really part of the master plan. I was just a part, just a tiny part, really insignificant. And I knew that, and I started, I don't know, not feeling resentful. When I got on Casualty, I felt a little bit out of the way, I felt a little bit ostracised.
Whereas,
like we were saying with Shane's, and it was, you're part of a group and you're all best mates.
Even if you're a small role on camera, you're a big role in the green room or whatever.
Exactly. So on jobs like Casualty, I found them quite difficult, and as well they were it was the rough parts that I'd been playing on telly like the first telly jobs were always rough parts and short films and stuff like that. I was playing rough chavvy fuckers, whereas when I was doing my theatre work, I was never me. I was never anything close to me. Whereas on these short films and little bitty parts, I was just acting like the rough me, really.
It was kind of turn up and do a rough version of yourself.
Yeah,
and then
exactly
it's not,
that. It's again, not really it's, that rewarding.
It's that tough thing. It was the first acting gig I did. I was working with Neil Maskell, and he said really early on, he was like, it's way harder to have a line here or there than to have a big role. He's like, if you've got a big role, number one, your motivation is that bit bigger and you can get into knowing the character.
Yeah.
If you've got a few lines here and there, you can't really, it's hard to get motivated. Obviously, you're still motivated. Stephen Graham says this to me most days, like when we're discussing stuff on set, of there's no small roles, there's only small actors.
Yeah.
But still, it's easier to, if there's something to get your teeth
of
into,
course,
right?
Mate.
So, but still, I guess you're cutting your teeth on proper productions, and you're seeing stuff, you're being in there. Although it might not be the roles of your dream, you're in there and you're on the front line, as it were.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think from the age of about, I'd say 19 to 21, really, for them 2 years, I was going up and down doing just like little parts. Casualty, bless them, they put me on as a semi-regular by the end.
Amazing.
I was Ryan Malone, the part of a really rough family on the estate. Like,
nice.
And I died by having an overdose of heroin.
Wow, there you go.
No, being stabbed, then having an overdose of heroin, and then me car crashed on the way to the hospital.
That's three deaths.
I was no way
that's,
coming
that's
back.
Essentially, that's really, they're
they
done with that,
people.
Aren't they?
Yeah,
that's big. Ones that jumped out when I was going through, before This Is England kind of made its way back, was Summer was obviously kind of a big deal and a big thing and a big moment for you.
Yeah.
So how was that when that kind of... It came about.
Well, that was the first time I worked with somebody who I thought was famous, which was Bobby Carlyle.
And
I liked that part, man. I felt that I worked really hard in being that character.
Yeah.
In being that character from that place, that life, which I don't know, I think even if you ain't actually gone through what that boy went through, then I've got a lot of mates who have.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was nice, man, and Bobby Carlyle was just sweet, and it was a job where I thought, fucking hell, it's going somewhere, this. If they've employed me for this big job, and I had about 5 auditions with Kenny, and we're having talks about my life, and we're going through impro after impro, and bringing new people in for auditions, for like mixing the auditions together and improv.
Yeah.
It was just fucking wicked, man. I loved that job.
And there must be kind of perfectly timed, because it was kind of a couple of years after you'd had the experience of This Is England kind of launching you into the world as such, and then you'd had a couple of years of not feeling it had gone where you'd hoped at that point, but a couple of years in reality, it's not long at all.
It's
kind of a good thing that then you get that other injection of a film like that, where you can kind of really get your teeth into it and think, right, this is going somewhere.
I learnt a lot on that job as well with Steve and Bobby. I used to watch them when I went on and watched the monitors and stuff, and I just fucking watched how I don't know, I can't say simple because it fucking ain't, but how
how great their performances were without doing much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just, what it sort of told me, you feel it, you're looking it. You know what I mean? Yeah. If you fucking invest and you're feeling the things that bloke's supposed to feel, you're going to look like you're feeling the things that bloke's supposed to feel.
It's so great to work with people that you respect in that way, that you can learn from in that way. Because the fact is, I guarantee that there's points where they're thinking, oh, I'm not really sure what I'm meant to be doing here. Or do you know what I mean? There's going to be certain days where I'm not sure about this one. But you're watching them again. Look at that. That's just magic. Simplicity. It's just,
yeah.
And that's the thing that I've had in my brief experiences on set, is watching people who I respect and am a fan of, who haven't got lines in a particular scene.
Yeah.
Because it's exactly that, of kind of going, all right, that's kind of, he's getting on with stuff. And I don't know what's going on in his head, but I know there's other stuff going on.
Yeah.
And getting that kind of thing across. Because they're the more nervous things. If you've got a monologue, you've practiced it and you're excited, you're like, I'm going to blow him away with this. If you're just in the background, they're the bits where it's like, I don't want to just look like I'm not doing anything, or I don't want to over, look as if I'm trying to edge onto camera in the background.
What actors are, though, what I find a lot of the time is that some actors are so desperate just to get themselves there on the screen or in the scene or whatever the fuck it is, that they completely sabotage the drama.
Yeah.
And I see that so fucking much, man.
100%.
That's an ego thing. That's just the ego.
But again, it's the beauty of people who haven't come from maybe that traditional form, is you don't seem to have that as much. And from speaking to you and Stevie and numerous others, it's more in my mind on set, it's like, right, where would my character be at this moment? Like, if there weren't any cameras here.
Yeah,
it's like, he'd be over here. I'm lying if I'd say...
If I'd be right amongst it there.
Yeah, exactly.
And in the middle of the circle.
Exactly. So it's kind of, it's finding those points and going, right, now let's just play it out. Because again, you learn quite quick as well. They're going to shoot it from a shit ton of angles and everything else. So if you're not kind of thinking, I need to be right next to that person, because you might be ruining that scene and they're not going to use that fucking angle anyway, so...
It's like the fucking bullshit debates you have, like three actors outside of a door. The amount of times this has happened, I think I should be at the front. Oh, no, I think I should be at the front.
Yeah.
Get the fucking... I just think, I couldn't give a flying fuck.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've got a brilliant reason, it's just, you can smell it.
A good reason, smell then fine, go ahead. Yeah. But you have had a good reason for the last 5 points where you weren't going to be at the front as well. So I'm starting.
You just want to get your head in, love. You just want to get your face in first. And it's sad when that's what it becomes, I think.
Yeah.
I think a lot of actors, some are lucky to get in the game, and a lot of them want to be seen. It's about being seen, and I just want to fucking convince. Really, I want people to believe, if anything.
And that's it. It's looking at it. I like that. It's looking at it like a long game. It's saying, I ain't going anywhere. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, I'm going to be doing this as my career now. So if I'm not in this scene, there's another gig, or if I'm killed off in Casualty, I know there's going to be another gig. I'm not going to be bummed out and say, don't kill me off. You can't kill me off. Yeah, I need this. I'm going to go, right, well, that was cool experience.
Yeah.
I wonder what's next.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
Before we get onto This Is England 86, a one that jumped out that I haven't seen was Dogging a Love Story. Right. I mean, just as a title, that's a hell of a name. But it was kind of a comedy and
it was a
right
comedy.
Thing. What was it?
I knew the director really well, Simon Ellis. He's a fucking top director and a lovely bloke. He really is. And I was at college, and I didn't have an agent then.
Yeah.
But Simon wanted me in his film that he'd been approached to direct. So I thought, fuck it. And it was my first lead in a feature film.
Wicked.
So, I mean, I jumped at the chance, and it was a funny part, and I really enjoyed playing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think the film's a brilliant, brilliant film.
Right.
But, I mean, it was a fucking good laugh.
Yeah.
And I met some great friends during it, and it was the first time I'd had a big part on a feature.
And that's exciting, and choosing things at points. Again, I think actors, I mean, look at us sitting here putting the acting world to rights. But I think in general, I think actors can over-worry too much about stuff sometimes. And if something comes in and you're about... And it seems like it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Then just taking it, it's a great experience. It's even if it doesn't turn out to be what you envisaged it could be, or even if beforehand you know it's not going to be your magnus opus, kind of thing. You're like, well, this is work and it's learning, and yeah. I'll take something from it and yeah. I'll get something out
I,
of
and
it.
And I was grateful, man. I was at college, yeah. I'd never done it before. I jumped at the chance as soon as I got the offer. I was like, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. First time I got to move out of home and go and live up north to go and do filming.
Yeah.
Oh, not wicked. Not work. Like, yeah, not normal yeah, yeah. work. It was filming work.
Yeah.
It was fucking brilliant.
That's great. So how was it when the call came in that This Is England was kind of being turned into a series now? And yeah. was it initially going to be... It was going to be several series from the offset, wasn't it? Like when 86 was...
I didn't have a clue. I didn't.
Yeah.
No, right, I didn't know if it was going to go again. When they told me that the film was going to go again, I had no idea that they was going to put me in it.
Yeah.
But Jack O'Connell, he couldn't do it. He was away just doing massive Hollywood films or whatever
yeah,
he was doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there was like a space, really, that needed filling. And Shane just said, are you up for it? He didn't tell me this, but I found out later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is how it went, really.
That's great news, though, right?
Of course, good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You take it how you can,
of course.
Can get it in that way.
So we asked if I'd do it, and I said, yeah, man, I'd love to. So I moved up to Sheffield with all these This Is England people, and we all lived in the same complex. It was just a fucking, it was a mad ass.
Amazing.
It was brilliant. It was mental, and we all partied hard, we cried hard, we worked fucking hard. It was a great time, and my career started picking up from that, from getting that job. I got Being Human from at the same time I was doing it. So
yeah, which was a massive one as well, and a character that... another one that grew, that you were kind of in there as a small character at first, wasn't it? And then it was like, right now he's one of the main...
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like almost that my auditions are during my work, really.
On set, yeah. I'm there. And again, I think that's a positive as well, that they're putting you in again. This lad's all right, or it's better than we thought, or more than we were expecting, and then going, all right, let's have more.
The boy's done good, bring him back.
Yeah, let's keep him on.
I remember they asked me on Being Human, they asked if I'd come again and be a series regular, and just the thought of then moving into one of the actual houses as opposed to a hotel, like the guest artist thing.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to rent me a flat for 6 months?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Like, It's my career picked up from This Is England 86 onwards, really.
So where did Being Human film? Was that in...
Cardiff.
Going out to Cardiff for a good while. Again, it's kind of that exciting thing, particularly when you're relatively young, to get these gigs where it's like, right now, you're going to come and live here for a while now and have, as well as this exciting times on set, you're going to be finding a new city and learning a new place and that, I guess.
Yeah, well, we're going to give you money to live on. We're going to give you money for your work. We're going to pay for your rent, and you're going to move to a wonderful city for a little bit. It was amazing.
Yeah, it's a dream, right?
Exactly that, man. I love Cardiff as well. And I love Being Human. I love that job because it was so far from Harvey that I played in This Is England.
Yeah.
Like this Tom McNair, man, he was a naive werepuppy. And it was just a character, and it was great to... do that hard shit that I'd done for so long, tough whatever for so long, that I could just be this bright-eyed, it's wide-eyed innocent little boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I loved, man. And I loved playing that part as well, because it also gave you, like Harvey, if Harvey was to have an emotional scene, it'd be hard to get to that point, you know. It'd be hard for Harvey to, I don't know, I think it'd have to be so spontaneous, or it'd have to be a fucking catastrophe, whereas the emotion for Tom, because he was so emotional anyway, and so...
Yeah, completely. You get to enjoy that and play about that. And again, work with another great group of people, with Toby, man, and all these other ones that were just a great cast and a great lineup there. So it seems to have kind of two gigs on the go that are these great ensemble casts that really people from all over the place, but everyone having their own character and their own, their own something about them.
Yeah. And the people who watched Being Human as well, they were like a certain audience. It was a cult show. So I sort of got another audience watching it, and it was reaching out to other people, which was, again, great, really. I love Being Human, and This Is England. Both of them are just fucking brilliant ones.
So how was it then, because you bounced back again to This Is England, and again, your character just kept growing and growing. Did that kind of seem natural, or did it seem like a surprise? As I said, the first time, you weren't sure if they were going to even put you in the series.
Yeah.
So by the second series... Or was it nice to see that this is growing and growing? This is you've won them over with this character. You've auditioned on the job.
You're like part of it. I mean, even by 86, I always felt like a little bit of an outsider.
Right.
Because even though I knew all of them so well, my character wise, because you are, you sort of are being your character all day. You're acting out that character. I felt a little bit, because he was a bully, he bullied Sean to begin with.
Initially.
And Shane asked me, he says, how did Harvey become friends with Sean? And I made up this story of him being battered by his dad, ran out, seeing Gadget, and Gadget sort of took Harvey under his massive wing, and then eventually just slowly got in with the group, I suppose. And
yeah.
I mean, it's like the story of, like, at school there used to be people I didn't get on with. 5 years later, you're at the pub and you're all right, mate, how's it going? Yeah. And you become best friends. Like, that's how it happens. You know, there's no explanation. You were just dicks at school. Yeah. That's what happened.
Exactly.
But, with 86, I didn't really feel completely part of it, really, until the end.
Yeah.
But by 88, I think I was just part of the gang then. I was just Harvey was part of the gang.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a theme now, but the other one that came up is, it's not a series I saw, but Once Upon a Time. And originally, so you were in Once Upon a Time in Wonderland.
Yeah.
And then again, kind of impressed on the job and became a regular in Once Upon a Time. I hadn't even noticed that, but it's such a weird theme that they're always like, we'll give him a small role. Oh, let's keep this one. This one's nice.
Yeah, he's doing all right.
So how was that? And where did that film? Because that must have been a very different setup and experience to all the kind of real... Even being human, although it was a supernatural, it was still quite a real and gritty kind of real life England kind of thing.
Of course, fucking Barry.
Yeah.
That's where the werewolves meet in Barry.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there you go.
It was all right, man. Wonderland, I self-taped here for Wonderland, and it was a spin-off. It was a pilot.
Yeah.
I got the offer on a job, which was a fucking good job, man. But I couldn't... I had to make a decision whether I'd do the... I'd gamble on going out to Vancouver and doing the pilot, or I could pay the bills and do this job.
Yeah.
But I thought, fuck it, man. Like, I've got to just try it. I've got to see what... I think a lot of people in that position would have took the chance anyway, just to see what it's like on fucking business class plane, you know what I mean?
And go and have a look. Again, it's that weird, exciting world of, I come over to a completely different culture and country and see how you fare. You know?
You might like it here.
Yeah.
But I loved that job. I loved the character. It was and obviously the fucking studio is massive and it's a big deal. It's Vancouver. They fly to LA to do interviews and did it. It's a completely different fucking world.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And I loved the character. Like I say, it was a cool character. I thought it was a bit of a pisshead and a bit of a rogue, but it was cool. I liked playing him. The Naval Arts. It was a cool character to play, and I had a great time. And then they brought me onto the main show, which.
Again, that's got to be high praise in many ways. They're going, you've gone down well. It's working. You know?
I felt brilliant, man. It was incredible. But when I was there, I wasn't really doing very much on the main show. Mm. I wasn't really in the episodes a lot. I didn't really have a story. I just seemed like a
boy having to be over there for a long.
I was over there, man, for like a year. And my little boy's crazy, here with his mum, and it's like, fuck, I just want to see my boy.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew the sacrifices I'd have to make when doing this job, but going over there, and if I was working, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
I'd have been working. I'd have felt like I'm there for a reason.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I wasn't really working, so I just had a lot of time to miss people.
It's a tough one, and it's hard for people to understand unless they're in it. I had Ed Skrein on last week, and he did a season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And he loved it, but... He left it, like he walked out on it, and they replaced him with someone else for his character, because it was exactly that. It was kind of, this is an amazing thing to be part of, but I'm such a small cog here. And it's not an arrogance thing or an ego thing. No. It's you've only got a certain amount of time in this game kind of thing. So can you afford at that point to give over 6, 8, however many months and be used every now and then? Or do you want to come back and do something that's maybe smaller, but will push you harder and make you grow more and learn more?
Yeah.
And again, even more so, again, he's the same. If you've got a kid back here, it's kind of a tough one to justify.
Yeah.
You know, sitting around a load in a hotel room or waiting in a trailer, you know?
My mum came out and stayed with me for 3 months when I was out there. Shimmy came out and stayed with me twice. It was just fucking, I had nothing to do.
Yeah.
I think originally there was... a plot and stuff, but I think the fans are so loyal to the characters that were already there, and rightly so. They're all great characters, great actors, great people. And I came along and there wasn't really space for me, I don't think.
Yeah, and TV's a tough one because it's always over such a stretch of time that there's so much potential of things changing and scripts changing and roles changing,
especially
and the size of your role changing. Yeah. You could on the first draft be a major thing, and by the time it's actually happening, you're essentially an extra, you know. Exactly, you kind of, so it's a really a tough one in that,
yeah,
in that instance.
I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I'm ever so grateful. I've seen interviews in the past that makes me look like a bit of a twat.
Right?
I just look like somebody who's a bit arrogant and a bit egotistical, but it ain't that. I was just fucking, I just needed to do something.
Yeah,
I was there for a reason. I wanted to do something there.
Yeah.
There's only so often you can look at mountains.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So how was it when This Is England 90 came round, because you had plenty to do there and some dramatic storylines, but also an awareness that this was planned as an end. This was kind of, this was a gig you'd had, what, for four or five years, recurring, you know, repeatedly coming back, or more than that, actually. Sorry, if it was 2006 was the film, wasn't it? So if it ended in 2015, that's almost 10 years.
Yeah.
So it was going to be a full stop. So how was that to know it was all coming to an end, but also to have scenes like when you walk into the bathroom and have to be really harsh and really, like, again, it was hugely exciting as a viewer, because it gave us so much of your character, of Harvey, of the strength, but also of just the no, this ain't, this is bullshit, you know. How was all that?
Shane asked me what would Harvey do if he caught Kelly doing heroin. I says, he'd fuck her off out. I think the fact that she was doing heroin wasn't enough to kick her out. The fact, it's what Harvey thought that Kelly was, how Kelly was treating Gadget, that Harvey didn't like.
Yeah.
I says, he's watched that for fucking years, that bitch coming in here, winding him up, being all sexy all the fucking time and not getting a smidgen out of it, you know what I mean? It's cruel.
Yeah.
And he gets to take the piss out of it. And I see that, but Harvey's never said it. Harvey's never fucking...
Yeah.
And then I think that was it.
Yeah.
That was his excuse. He'd had enough. Kelly had been pissing him off anyway. Kelly's just his fucking idiot anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that was just his... I think that's why I took that decision, just to get a fucking... It was nothing to do with the heroin, really. It was just an excuse to get her out.
And it was great, because it had that harshness, but it had that feeling in there as well. It was like, no, I'm not going to allow you to treat Gadget like this. I'm not going to stand here while you're treating yourself like this. And it was all that kind of, as much as on one level or on paper, it could have been, he's caught her, he's pissed off, she's out. It didn't have that feel, you know. It was like, you can't act like this. That isn't acceptable behaviour. I need to put my foot down in some way. Because everything that's going on right now, that's not how humans are meant to treat each other or to be or to look after themselves and all that.
I think with that scene as well, it was quite silent. Yeah. And I love silence, man. I think there's some fucking great performances. Like when we're all just sitting eating fucking dinner.
Yeah.
Love that shit, man. Just because there's fucking no one speaking. Not everyone speaks all the fucking time.
100%. It's not all slick Kevin Smith written dialogue that's witty and funny all the time. A lot of it is just people just having a bit of quiet.
Well, when my mum used to tell me off, whatever, there'd be times in between my tellings off that just be fucking quiet.
Yeah.
While she's thinking of more shit to say to me and I'm thinking of excuses to give, it just be, you know, that's basically it. You're just fucking thinking. You ain't saying nothing, you're thinking. And I love that. I love watching people's heads think as opposed to fucking saying what they think, man.
Yeah. And it's such a rare thing as well. Again, we keep going back to it, but so many actors are chomping for that extra bit of dialogue at an extra moment. And the beauty again of, I'd imagine, of working with a cast and crew who are all just there for each other. There isn't that competition of I need to get more lines than Joe, or I need to do this or that. It's like everyone just, it must have been a relaxed atmosphere in that way, that if you're workshopping anything, you're comfortable just shutting up for a bit if you need to, not thinking I've not said anything for a good 5-10 minutes now, I should probably chip in. You can be more, no, this is,
be truthful,
this is,
man.
Fine,
be, play the truth, not the noise.
Yeah
That's what I always think.
That's great. So I won the shows I'm absolutely loving at the moment. I think by the time this comes out it will have just finished, but I'm loving Aliens at the moment. I think it's fantastic, and it's great because, again, that's a big role for you. That's you're in the lead. You're
that's my
holding.
That's my first lead of a new show.
Yeah. But again, it's an amazing show. It's got that kind of tone and vibe that Channel 4 seemed to pull off in Utopia, in Misfits, in fact, which obviously your sister's in, and another great series. But it seems to have that tone and vibe that's just, weirdly exciting, and you're not sure why. But then equally, it's got you, it's got a Michael Smiley, and loads of
Smiley,
just,
man.
Yeah, amazing actor and amazing
Kayla Cole,
yeah,
Jim Harwick,
yeah,
Bronson fucking Webb,
yeah.
I couldn't believe I saw when he was there on the first day. Well, I looked through the call sheet and I seen Bronson Webb when he was there. I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. And I was a big fan of Bronson's before I even knew what acting was. Me and my friend watched a thing called Out of Control by Dominic Savage.
Yeah.
Dominic Savage. And I got to work with Dominic years later, me and Jack O'Connell did. But I was a fan of Bronson's from a long time ago.
Yeah.
I loved the job, man. I loved the job. I sort of tweaked Lewis, though, I did by the end.
Yeah.
In the early episodes, I made Lewis really, I even changed physically. I sort of the way I walk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'd not really done that much with any other jobs.
Yeah.
Because I'd never really played someone as, I don't know, really sort of straight laced.
Yeah.
Geeky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a bit fucking weird.
Yeah.
I'd never played anybody like that before, which was great.
And again, it's great because he is a character that, you kind of go on the journey with him as you know he's being tricked or used and abused, but he's not an idiot.
No.
Do you know what I mean? It's not like it's this idiot character that's being exploited. He's a perfectly reasonable, he's a regular person. He feels like someone you know, but you're seeing it each time he's being led down a path or led down somewhere. And it's nice in that way. There's an innocence to it.
Yeah.
And it is, it's from the presentation physically and vocally and everything, I guess.
Yeah. It was, I don't know, man, it was time to do a little bit of character work,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then I read an interview with Johnny Harris, and he was saying in the interview something along the lines of, I'm not going to be versatile just for the sake of just for other people to tell me that I'm versatile.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, fuck, I've just done this little character thing now. And that's from Johnny Harris, who I fucking love.
Yeah.
Fucking love to death.
Well, Smiley's a great one for that, and he kind of was saying, when I had him on the podcast, in fact, Smiley, I've had Tom Davis on, who's
fucking
in a few, who's lovely,
and
some great scenes. So,
yeah.
But he said the breakthrough thing for him was when people were casting essentially Michael Smiley, and it allowed him to then just concentrate on nuances. He wasn't having to go, right, who's this character having to be? He's like, they're casting him in many ways, or someone very close to him,
yeah.
And he gets to kind of go, right, let's really get these kind of tiny little bits, these nuances, as you said, the way he's standing, all these other things, and go, I don't have to worry about a different accent or a different, or this or that. It's very much me, but I can finesse it and tweak it. And that's where, again, he's had some absolute classic performances. That,
yeah, man.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Lobster?
Yeah, yeah.
Fucking brilliant film.
I thought it was great,
I loved it. I mean, I think I am an advocate of the truth. I want to massively, I want people to believe what I do.
Yeah.
But then selfishly, I like doing characters.
Yeah,
it's
of course.
Fun. It's, that's what I did it to begin with.
Yeah.
That's why I did it to begin with, sorry. Like doing me amateur dramatic. Because I was being a character.
It feels like
brilliant. You're
achieving more, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going out there and you're playing something. It's not just go out there and say these lines in your words and then you're kind of lucky that it's like, well, they happen to want me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just by chance, they wanted to put me in it and I'm in it. You know, that's lovely
all the
same, but still, after you've been doing it a while, I'd imagine you do kind of want to go, let's show them and give them the reason that there's that I'm in this and I'm in this opportunity.
Yeah. I think that's it. That nowadays, the jobs where I can truly dive into a character are few and far between. A lot of the time, I'm just sort of being bits of myself, being aspects of myself. And I think with Aliens, I've got to not be anything like myself, really. I'm nothing like Lewis.
Yeah.
Apart from... No, nothing really. I don't think there's any similarities, and I hope that I mean,
you look quite
that
similar.
We look the same. I think his eyebrows are more refined. Yes. Is it refined? Defined.
But so, how was it having that kind of that pressure? Was that an exciting thing? That it's like, right, I'm at the forefront now, and particularly through the prep and the making of it, there's a lot of pressure on you. But then equally, like when it's about to launch and come out. Did it feel different, or is that something you kind of ignore a bit, or were you on top of that?
But to a point, there is a bit of pressure always that you don't want anyone to go, it's fucking shy, and you were shy. That's what it is. But I've done shows before where it's sort of not necessarily all on me, but I'm part of an ensemble where it matters if I was good or not, and I was in it a lot.
Yeah.
So the pressures, it wasn't any different from any other job, really.
Yeah.
Other than maybe like the Vancouver ones, because yeah. that was where I lived in the world depended on whether I got that job or not. It was it was more drama, I suppose, with knowing if how well it's being received over there.
Yeah, of
and it
course.
Can affect your life financially and
yeah, 100%.
I suppose in your career, it can really fucking change over there.
Yeah,
but here it was. I don't know. It was. I felt like I almost knew the E4 bunch anyway.
Yeah,
I feel as though I'm like a Channel 4 baby. I think I'm part of a few people who have worked quite a lot on Channel 4.
Yeah,
especially like Michaela Cole, like your Joey Gilgans, like.
Yeah,
I always thought that I just felt at home.
Yeah,
being on an E4 show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They kind of knew what they were getting because they've got it before. So it's kind of that pressure's off a little bit because you. It's like no, there's
they know
me.
Again.
They know me.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be. You get on set and they're like, that wasn't what we were.
Didn't like that.
That wasn't. Yeah, wasn't hoping for that at all. But
yeah,
that's perfect then. So, I mean, we're getting close to the hour marks, so I'll start to wrap things up soon. But just talking, and again, we don't have to go into it in great detail if you'd rather not, but acting is a weird industry in that, as you said, it'll be a drop of a hat and you're off for 5 months here or whatever else. Being a father,
yeah.
How do you find that and balancing that and kind of does that affect your job choices? In any way, because again, there's that kind of thing. You might be away for a long time, but if it's a gig that's going to help a lot financially and career wise, then it's worth. Do you know what I mean? It's balancing it all, I guess.
Well, I knew before I had a kid that I was always going to be an actor.
Yeah,
I can't do fuck all else. I don't want to do nothing else.
Yeah,
so I always knew. And when I was with Alice's mum, we always said that. Yeah, I'm going to always be an actor. Like,
yes,
this is
that
it.
Is what it is. Yeah,
and
yeah,
we
yeah.
made an agreement that's cool. When he was like one or two, it was very difficult because there wasn't really anything he could say to me. I'd just hear a bit of crying when I spoke to his mum.
Of course. So when you're getting them Skype calls or phone calls or whatever else, it's that typical thing of, all right.
Yeah, he's still there, is he?
Do you want to talk to him for a bit? Yeah. I'd love to,
but like
he's also, not pulling his weight in this conversation.
Yeah, speak to it's me. It's my selfishness.
Yeah,
I want you to make me feel good.
Yeah, yeah.
But I bring him out anywhere I go. He comes like everywhere. Brilliant. Lucky enough, his mum will bring him out to anywhere I am.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it gets hard. Sometimes it's hard, especially working away or abroad or wherever. But just it is difficult. When I'm working in England, I always think I can just drive. You know what I mean? He ain't far.
Yeah.
I can bring him to me. It's really easy. It is difficult. And I sometimes have massive... Like the Once Upon a Time job, that was when I really started missing him and thinking, fuck me, I'm really putting my career in front of my child at this point.
It's a long time away and it's an ocean away. And that makes... It's weird how much of a difference that makes.
And also, he's starting to... Like he's doing his preschool. He's starting to get a life. You know what I mean? He's starting to do things that he enjoys. Yeah. Like he picks and chooses. So it's like, I can't really inflict my life on him anymore.
Yeah.
I can't go, you're coming here now. You've got to do this. As he's got older, we have a great relationship. We speak a lot. And I very stupidly put him onto something the other day. I let him watch Aliens.
Yeah.
It was episode 4. Well, I let him watch a little bit. He fucking bored his eyes out.
Really?
I don't want daddy to be sad. And it's just like, right,
man.
Now he's picking up on things and he's getting it now. He's like, so I can't show him out I'm in anymore.
Do you think that's going to influence your choices though at all? Because again, it's, you know, if something comes along that your boy can watch, then that's going to be exciting, right? The first time you get a gig like that isn't more of an adult thing and that you can go, oh, that'll be nice.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's going to influence it, surely, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think... I would ever turn down a job because of me boy.
Yeah.
I'd it might sound fucking awful, but that's the case. Like I would never turn a job down because I've got a son.
That's fine because it's choosing what they get to see or whatever else. It's still, you know, at some point he'll be the age that you are when you're doing this.
Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean? If you can see that it's a good role, you know that at some point, you know, he could get that.
But also, I think I'd be bitter if I all of a sudden went, right, I ain't doing acting no more. I want to be at home in Derby. I'd lose my mind.
Yeah.
I'd go fucking mental. And he's a big boy now. Well, he's bigger. So he's vocal. We talk a lot on FaceTime and he comes over to see me all the time, wherever I am.
Yeah.
But I've been back in Derby for a few months now, and it's nice. It's really nice. Yeah. Oh, my next job's in London, so it's just down the fucking road.
It's not far at all, is it? It's
doable. Everything's cool.
So let's talk about that. You've got a stage gig coming up. How much are you shitting yourself about that?
Massively shitting myself.
There's no messing about on stage, is there?
Mate, not at all. I don't know what happens, but if you forget your line, do you have to just improvise something?
I've got a clue, man. I'm petrified of it. A guy I worked with, I'm going to have on the podcast at some point, this guy Fergal I worked with in the Guy Ritchie film I did, which the first thing I did, we had some reshoots that the other week, and he works in the Globe and does loads of Shakespeare stuff, and he's doing two different Shakespeare plays at the moment, and on some days it's back to back, and it blows my mind to think you can do that. But again, he was saying that you get into the flow of it and it's not that big a deal. It's like anything, you get used to. He was saying his only struggle is when they're doing a two in a row, there's another actor in it who in both plays they've got scenes together walking along chatting. And that's the only tough bit, because you can get in too much of autopilot and be like, oh shit, hang on, which conversation are we meant to be having? But again, if you're only doing one, that's fucking easy, mate. You shouldn't be worrying.
Yeah, it's a very emotional fucking play, though.
Yeah,
I can imagine. But I ain't done theatre in 10 years, nearly 10 years.
So it must be exciting to get back to that, particularly as that was what originally excited you. The fact you didn't get that role in Bugsy Malone, and then you did get that role.
And it was the buzz of being on stage that I loved. I fucking loved it, man. When I first come off the stage on opening night, when I first did Bugsy for the Amateur Dramatics, I was just ecstatic. I don't know, man. Rare do you feel like that. Just fucking electric, and you don't really know what the fuck to do with yourself apart from scream or something, or chant or whatever the fuck. But this play I chose to do because I fucking like the play. I like reading it. And I wouldn't have gone back into theatre unless I liked the thing that I'm doing.
That's wicked.
But this was, banging, man. And Liam Borrett, the director, the writer, is just banging.
So where is it and what is it? Because by the time this comes out, you'll probably just be finishing off the rehearsals and about to kick into it.
I'll start rehearsals on the 25th, and then it'll be on, I don't even know the dates. I think it's 3-4 weeks rehearsal and then 4-week performance. Trafalgar 2. They call it an intimate theatre.
It's called what?
An intimate theatre.
An intimate date.
That means there's not that many fucking heads there, basically. Yeah, there's only 100 seats in it.
Nice.
I don't know. You can probably see the heads, though, then. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm so scared. You're
right in the middle of it, isn't it? Everyone's engaged. It's going to be exciting, though, surely.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's going to be exciting. And I was speaking to my agent the other day about that. It's going to test me again. It's going to give me something that I've got to fucking really get into.
It's so important to have them things that re-push you and make you realise. Again, I was talking, it was before we started rolling with Ed Skrine the other day, we were talking about Paddy Considine, who just absolutely adore, and it was amazing to talk to him and hear that after Dead Man's Shoes, after A Room for Romeo Brass, a few acting gigs down the line, he went, I need to get in a class and have some lessons. And it's great because it's him realising, he's like, right, I've done these things, but I can't do everything. And again, it blew my mind because they're two of my favourite
performances
on camera. Both of those performances.
Why would a man like that need acting classes?
Yeah, just blow your mind. So it's great that to have that realisation, or to be bold enough to be, or aware enough of yourself to go, right, no, I still need to push myself. I still need to prove. And it's a similar thing here where you're going, right, I'm scared of this. And that's the reason I have to do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's why it has to be done. Because this is a scary thing to push me and develop me.
Yeah. And it's coming closer now. And it's like every day I wake up, I'm thinking, it's gonna start soon.
So is that your pure focus at the moment? Is there anything else ahead that we can talk about? Again, it's the toughest question every time I have an actor on, because asking what's ahead is normally like, well, I can't talk about this project and I can't talk about that. Is there anything else in the plan?
I ain't got nothing after the play. Me and my friends, we're trying to write. We've always been trying to write.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know, we always seem to write something and give up on that and then write our own little thing. But we've come together now and we've sort of been desperate to write this, I suppose, a sketch show, but it's a bit sort of alternate. It's a sketch show at the moment that we're writing, but it's also, I don't know, like a Vice magazine. I think it's got a bit of what we want in it, basically.
Yeah, wicked.
Just something that, even if it doesn't fucking go anywhere on the telly, we did the fucker.
It's fun to do. And mate, the biggest challenge in all these things, I generally think, is finishing something.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's good or not is a different thing, but actually finishing something is what 90% of people don't do.
Yeah.
And again, I've got like three scripts I'm working on that I'm not even close to.
Yeah.
Most of them I've not started, but still it's that thing of, finding out how you finish these things is the biggest deal.
When is it finished? That's the thing, isn't it?
And the beauty as well of these days is because of the way it all is online and technology is a lot of things you can just make, you know, potentially. It doesn't have to be this big thing. It doesn't have to be a Channel 4 thing. It doesn't have to be this or that. It can just be something you make.
It's just a bit of something, you know what I mean? I forget how my friend Lee described it the other day. It sounded brilliant, but I can't fucking remember it. But that's it. It's just getting on with it and doing the fucker. And if you don't, then what the fuck are you going to do? What is there left?
Exactly. It's filling that time in between gigs, in between inspiration, in between, moments and opportunities. So.
Yeah.
Filling out. Well, thank you very much, man.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lovely having a chat. And I look forward to see any of you hold it together in this play and survive.
Jesus Christ, we'll see.
Well, thank you very much. I'll let you get on with your day. Cheers, mate.
Nice of us.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Piece.
There you go. What a lovely dude. Yeah, I really enjoyed that chat. I've had a few recently that have been the first time I've met someone and it's just felt really nice and natural. Ed Skrine and Michael Socker. Ed Skrine last week, that went crazy. Thank you all for supporting that. That was kind of big. And Michael this week, just kind of as soon as we met, it was just a really relaxing and nice conversation. Big love to both of them. Thank you for tuning in. Tune in next week, because in the coming weeks, we've got a lot of great guests. We've got Kathy Burke. We've got Izzy Sooty. We've got a load of others I've got lined up and prepared for you. So it's exciting times. And if you subscribe and set it to auto-download, then you'll never miss these exciting times. They'll just pop up. They'll pop up once a week and be on your phone. And then you'll get up and go to work and go, oh, there it is. It's already on my phone. It won't be like, oh, damn it, I didn't download it. And now I'm using up all my data. It'll just be there. So I recommend that. That's always a good thing to do. Thanks, everyone, for supporting Tuesday Night Jaw as well. I keep only remembering this at the end. But we launched Tuesday Night Jaw a few weeks back now, 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago now. And it went nuts, man. We released it. We recorded it on a Tuesday. And we finished at just before... No, we finished at almost 6 on the dot. It was uploaded by 6:30. And by, I think I got home at about 8. By 8, it was number 2 sports podcast in the iTunes chart. It just went crazy. And it's a wrestling podcast, and it's hosted by Jim Smallman, who has previously been on the podcast as well. And it's trying to be a bit of a positive wrestling podcast, because there's tons of wrestling podcasts that just... dig out. If they're talking WWE, dig out. And this first one was WWE heavy, because it was 2 days after WrestleMania, for God's sake. Of course it's going to be. In general, there's going to be a great variation of wrestling talk, from old to new, past to present, big to small, independent to the big show and the big show. But yeah, thank you for tuning in and supporting that whole subscribe thing. It means the world. So if you want to subscribe to both Distraction Pieces and Tuesday Night Jaw, then that'd be wicked. But if you don't, you don't have to. Oh, no, I'm starting one of them long rambling outros again. Oh, no, these happen sometimes. If my voice goes soft at the end, it means I'm going to get all rambly. I had a nice drive up to Derbyshire to do this podcast with Michael. And I stopped off on the way back in Birmingham. Had a lovely evening. Had some vegan food. And generally... wonderful and magical evening in Birmingham. I love Birmingham, man. It's the only place I do my club night outside of London now. Every now and then we get tempted to Milton Keynes, but that's because we did one there and they were nice kids. But Birmingham's the one. We've done it in Manchester over the years and all over the place, but Birmingham's the one that we go back to, because I got a lot of love for Birmingham. I used to live in the Midlands. I lived in Wolverhampton. I told you it was turning into a long rambling outro. I lived in Wolverhampton. I went there for uni. I spent a year doing photography at uni, photography and film studies. I got good grades, but I wasn't really feeling that there was a great benefit of getting a degree in an arts-based subject, because it felt more the experience of going out and building a portfolio was more important. So I started to do that. While I was there, I did an illegal thing. I did a protest. I put up a billboard. It was a freedom of speech protest. And it was a massive photo of my face with tape over my mouth. I didn't have a beard then, so it was easier to tape my mouth. With tape over my mouth that said, like, fuck. And what the plan was, and what we did, me and... I won't actually name anyone else and get them in trouble. I mean, let's put this all down as a theoretical fictional story to build my character of Scroobius Pip online. Never really happened. Let's pretend that. But so we put this up, and we put our white sheets up next to it so that we could spray freedom of speech ? And it was a freedom of speech protest. So it said freedom of speech ? And then it had my face tape over my mouth and said like fuck. It was kind of weird that I didn't get caught, considering it was a 30-foot picture of me, but that's fine, that's cool. The beautiful part was the police came, and they didn't remove it. They censored it. They tore off the word fuck, which I found to be a beautiful irony. I went back in this theoretical world. This didn't really happen, don't arrest me. In this theoretical world, I went back and sprayed Point Proven over the ripped-off part, because it was kind of a beautiful irony. And I lived in the Midlands. I'd lived in Wolverhampton for a year, but I used to go and visit Chris of the Drunk Podcast, Chris Glasson of Redshift Rebels. I used to go and visit him and Mark Irvine of Mark Irvine Fest in Birmingham a lot, because they were at uni in Birmingham. And that started my love affair with Birmingham, which has never ended. And obviously Polar Bears from Birmingham and Jodie Ann Bickley, a lot of people I've worked with a lot and got a lot of love for. So it's a lovely place. I like a bit of Birmingham. We do the club night every now and then at the Hare and Hound in King's Heath, which is kind of outskirts of Birmingham, kind of like Bromsgrove and things like that are kind of outskirts, and Redditch, I don't know, all them kind of bits. Is it Brom? Have I just made that up? I might have made that up. But yeah, is that the end of the pod? That feels like that's the end of the podcast. It bloody isn't, is it? It's going on longer. I don't think it's ever ending. But yeah, it was lovely to chat to Michael. I'm hoping to catch him in his play, in London town. That'll be exciting. That's probably the end of the podcast. I'm a bit spun out. I'm busy with a lot of filming at the moment, man, so I've recorded all these intros at once. So, like, these last 3 weeks of intros, where it seems like I'm all, like, fresh each week and being all topical and current, I'm not. I took a breath in between each one. Like, that last one, like, last week's one where I ended Ed Skrein, and then I was like, all right, bye. I barely finished the word bye before going, welcome, 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 and doing... I can't lie to you guys. I'm lifting up the curtain. Sometimes when I'm, you know, really busy, because this isn't my full-time job, obviously, I'll stockpile these podcasts and record them. And each week I'll all be like, hey guys, how are you? As if we're having a real fucking conversation. We're not. I recorded it weeks ago. You might be feeling that I'm talking to you today. I ain't talking to you today. I'm talking to you a Saturday ages ago. So, This might end up being the longest podcast I've ever done. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else I need to tell you now. I'm rambling. There's not really. Taboo's going really good, man. I've had some great scenes. I can't go into detail, but, man, to be working with Stephen Graham and Tom Hardy and these amazing people is nuts. So I'm loving that French Bill all the way. French bloody Bill. I reckon that's the end of the podcast. I've asked you to subscribe and stuff. I normally do that. I know none of you want to. I know that's a ball ache. I know you go, oh, he's fucking asking us to subscribe again. Mate, I think it as I'm saying it. As I say it, I'm like, oh, I'm bloody asking them to subscribe again. What a yawn. But if you can, it helps, I guess. It's nice, isn't it? No one cares. As long as you're listening, that's all that matters. I had some people ask if
if listening on other apps help the iTunes chart. No, they don't, but the fact that you're listening is the bit that counts. Charts are cool because they help you get more exposure and push you to an audience that wasn't already there, but other than that, you know, who gives a fuck? So I might be going mental and having a breakdown at the end of this podcast. This might never end. Buddy Peace, who has to edit these, is going to be listening to this in Thailand, just going like, oh my God, what is Pip doing? Hey, buddy. I do rambling conversations to him at the start that you guys don't get to hear, but yeah, I should probably call it a night. Call it a night. I've not eaten any meat this week. I decided to have a meat-free week. I get a lot of shit from vegans online sometimes, and I'm not anti-vegans at all. believe I'm a big fan of vegans. It's good, but I get a lot of people arguing with it. But you know, I do think that us as humans eat too much meat. I'm just a meat eater. I've got my beliefs. I won't go into it because people get angry. But I decided to have a no meat week. I've had fish, so I had a pescatarian week, right? I had a couple of days of straight vegetarian, maybe even a full day of veganism in there, just thrown in for shits and giggles. But that's what's going down. I will talk to you guys soon. There will be a podcast. I mean, there might be a podcast next week. This might just continue. You might still be listening to this, but it might be next week by the time this finishes and by the time I finish this outro. DistractionPiecesPodcast.com. That's a place that you can find stuff. The YouTube channel. I ain't mentioned that in ages. We've got a Distraction Pieces, a YouTube channel, and the dudes that run that work their little asses off, and they do it as a favour, as an intern type thing. And they work their little asses off, and they take segments of the podcasts, some little highlights, and just make them as little a YouTube clip, so you can share them and discuss them and get or relive these little bits from previous episodes. Because often you might not want to get into a whole 90 minutes or whatever of an episode, like revisit it. But this is why some podcasts have co-hosts, to kind of hold things together a bit and not just make it one person's rambling nonsense. Thanks for everyone who downloads, man. It's mental that we get, like, we had a millionth download of the year the other week, and this is a few weeks on, so we're going to be well past that now. We're averaging 100,000 a week, and sometimes a load more than that, which is mental. It's mental. So thank you for that. It's growing and growing, and it's going to keep growing, hopefully. This is now the longest podcast that's ever happened. I am going to end it now because I need to go and eat food and drink water. So that's my advice to you guys. If at any time this week you get hungry, eat some food. And if you get thirsty, drink some water or a liquid of your choice, but drink something if you get thirsty. If you get tired, good thing for tiredness is sleeping. Try that. I recommend it. If you get tired, sleep, or at least sit down, or lay down, or just relax if you're tired. So just to run through that again, if you get hungry, eat. If you get thirsty, drink. If you get tired, rest. If you need the toilet, that's self-explanatory. We don't need to go into that. It's not that kind of podcast. You know what to do in that situation. Just try and do it in as cleanly a manner as possible. I think you should all live till next week now. I've given you all this advice. So next week, we're going to have another podcast. I'll be there. So there's that. Thanks for tuning in, guys. This has been the Strange Pieces Podcast, episode 95. See you next week. And also, you're dead to me.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership.
dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.